We're discussing sickle cell disease in a new UW clinic focused on improving long-term quality of life for patients. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In the U.S., about 100,000 people battle intense pain and life-threatening complications like strokes from this inherited blood disorder, where cells turn into the shape of a sickle and get trapped in blood vessels. Do you have sickle cell disease? How do you treat and manage it? How has it affected your life? What questions do you have about the disease? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Muniba Nazif is a hematologist at UW Health and head of this new sickle cell disease clinic. Dr. Nazif, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me over.
Good morning. Start by giving us a better understanding of what is sickle cell disease.
Yes. So as you very rightly said, sickle cell disease is an inherited blood disorder, which results in an abnormality in the red cells, which are our primary oxygen carriers in the blood. And this abnormality results in the red cells becoming misshapen, like crescents or sickle, and that results in blockages of the blood vessels, leading to intense pain and multiple organ complications. And it's a complex and chronic medical condition, which affects a patient's life, from birth almost to the end of their life, and is characterized by pain and, multiple complications, hospitalizations. So it's a big, medical, problem, and it impacts people of various ethnicities, but mainly people of African origin, African American or African origin, and some Hispanic ethnicities as well.
And we're going to talk about ethnicity in a moment, but what does it do to the internal organs?
So as you can imagine, we need oxygen in every tissue for it to function properly. So with sickling, when the blood cells become misshapen, they're not able to carry oxygen efficiently to the tissue. So a lot of organs get impacted by it, as every organ is dependent on that. So some of the kind of key examples are people can get strokes related to this disease because of interruption of blood supply. The sickling can lead to congestion in the blood vessels in the lungs, leading to serious complications with breathing. The bones can get affected and resulting in death of the bone tissue, and joints getting damaged, damage to the kidneys, liver. It can impact and damage the spleen, which helps to protect you from infection. So people are more predisposed to infections.
It really wreaks havoc on the body. Yeah. Is there a screening at birth, or how is it diagnosed?
Yes. So in the United States, a screening is done at birth, which will then identify these individuals. So that's how we know here, but there is in the rest of the world, it's not that screening program is not everywhere. So there is a test that they can be done, and sometimes the children are diagnosed around 6 months of age when they come in with painful, swollen joints and jaundice and a lot of sort of complications related to that.
We're talking with Dr. Muniba Nazif, who is a hematologist at UW Health, head of a new sickle cell disease clinic. What questions do you have about this chronic disease? Do you have sickle cell disease? How do you treat and manage it? Join in 800-642-1234. A bit of the genetics here, Dr. Nazif. How is it inherited?
So sickle cell disease is what we call an autosomal recessive disease, which means that, you know, every individual carries two genes for the normal globin, which is the gene that is impacted. And so if you inherit two abnormal genes, one from each parent, that's when you get sickle cell disease. If you inherit just one abnormal gene and you have a normal gene from the other parent, then you have what we call a sickle trait, which is an asymptomatic condition. So that does not cause disease, but they are able to transmit that to their offsprings in that manner. So you have to have two abnormal genes to inherit the disease.
Mm-hmm. Why does this really painful chronic disease disproportionately affect people of African ancestry or people who identify as Black?
Yes. So that has to do something with, sort of like the evolution of disease. Originally, this was sort of like it started and it was kind of like seen, if you go back into history, where predominantly in areas which in Africa and some parts of Middle East and even India. But the reason why the gene is being selected is because of the fact that people who do carry one abnormal gene or sickle trait, they are relatively protected from malaria. Mm-hmm. So over time, this gene was selected because these people were able to survive that, and the gene got concentrated. And as you know, because these are the regions in the world where the malaria is endemic, so mm-hmm. so that's sort of like kind of how the gene has been selected for, and now it's sort of mainly is found in that. But like I said, it's a global problem, so it's not just Africans, but also people from Hispanic ancestry, also some Middle Eastern and as well as Indian origin folks as well can have that.
Well, let's bring in a call. Bill is joining us from Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Good morning, ladies. Long ago, my blood was analyzed. I don't know what it was for, but this lady told me I had a recessive sickle cell gene, that if I had had children, which I did not, that they would have had the disease. My father said it's outrageous, but I wonder if that's possible, because no one in my family has ever had it, to my knowledge.
Dr. Nazif?
Yes, thank you for that question, Bill. So as I mentioned, there are 1 in 12 African Americans carry the sickle cell gene, so which means that people can have or are have sickle cell trait. So that means that you can have one abnormal gene, but if your other gene is normal, then you will not have the disease. But if you had children with someone who also carried the gene, then there's a possibility, about 1 in 4 possibility, that the child could end up with an abnormal gene from both parents, which will then can result. So not 100%, but there's a possibility that the child can have sickle cell disease.
We're talking with oncology and hematology specialist Dr. Muniba Nazif, who leads a new sickle cell clinic at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Does a loved one have sickle cell disease? How hard has it been for them to get treatment and care? If you have the disease, what has the quality of care you received been like? Have you explored gene therapy or had a bone marrow transplant? We'll be talking about that next. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the future of sickle cell disease as a new clinic is focused on it at the UW. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. An estimated 100,000 people in our country have the disease, and sickle cell disease patients have confronted systemic racism in medicine. A pair of physicians writing in the New England Journal of Medicine said sickle cell disease was first described more than a century ago, but the development of disease-modifying therapies has stagnated. What questions do you have about the inherited blood disorder? Do you find barriers to treatment? Join in 800-642-1234. Dr. Muniba Nazif is a hematologist at UW Health and leads the new clinic. Dr. Nazif, can you explain some of the treatment protocols? What might current treatment look like?
Yes, so there are several aspects of treatment of sickle cell disease. Obviously, one of the main things is to control the pain and manage the complications related to pain. But then the other main aspect is to manage the actual disease itself to reduce the complications of the disease and to improve the patient's quality of life. So there are medical treatments, so that includes medications. We have four new approved medications. I would say three new approved medications and one older medication that we use. There are blood transfusions, and then there are curative treatments such as bone marrow transplants and some an ongoing research in other curative treatments. So it involves all of those things in order to provide comprehensive care.
With these curative treatments on the horizon, first with, you know, blood marrow transplants, how well have they worked?
So bone marrow transplant is the only approved curative treatment for sickle cell disease, which essentially involves removing the patient's own immune system and then putting in a new immune system and a new sort of like blood cell system that will, from a donor, to then produce normal blood cells. So it's a treatment that works, but the currently the best available evidence is in patients who are younger, usually younger than 16 years of age, and they have a matched sibling. So they have to have a sibling who is a full match to the patient to be able for this treatment to be able to be successful. And so because of that, that has led to, you know, so it's not available to every patient, and only about 20% or less patients actually end up getting a bone marrow transplant in the United States.
What are you seeing out of gene therapies that are on the horizon?
It's a very promising area in sickle cell disease. We're very excited to see that happening. Gene therapy essentially is a technology that utilizes different kind of techniques to change the behavior of the gene in order to produce normal red cells. And it does not require a donor to give their stem cells, which makes it very attractive. It's in early phases of research currently, but the small amount of studies that we have seen are very promising. And I think that that's something that we are looking at expectantly. And we're hoping that more trials can be opened and more patients can enroll. And so we can get robust data and we can then work on seeing if we can, you know, if this would be applicable and we can provide this this treatment to patients.
Speaking of clinical trials, what trials might your clinic focus on?
We want to bring various clinical trials to our patients, ranging from new medications, which can have still, and I think will still have a role in management of sickle cell disease and its various complications. But we also hope for bringing some of these groundbreaking treatments like gene therapy trials to UW as well. There are a lot of kind of like initiatives that we are currently in the process of to be able to focus on in terms of sickle cell, and also a lot of quality-based interventions to improve patients' experiences.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Moniba Nazif, who's a hematologist at UW Health, head of a new sickle cell disease clinic. Taking your questions about the disease, does a loved one have sickle cell disease? How difficult has it been for them to get treatment and care? What is quality of life like? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Nazif, going back to the emerging gene therapy treatments, the cost of these treatments are extraordinarily high, in the millions of dollars. What is being done about, you know, barriers to access in gene therapy?
That's a great question. I think gene therapy is currently, it's not in, I have to clarify that it's not an approved treatment yet. Mm-hmm. So we are not using it sort of in a general manner for patients. It's currently only being done in the context of clinical trials. But just taking clue from other gene therapy treatments that are approved, we do understand that, yes, they are very expensive. And so there is a lot of work that is, and a lot of discussions that are currently ongoing at various levels for advocating for our patients and in discussions to sort of like address that while we are getting all this great data and going through these clinical trials. At the government level, I think there is advocacy. American Society of Hematology is championing a lot of these discussions. And so to bridge that gap and say that, you know, hey, we have this great treatment that we can cure this disease potentially, and it's, you know, it can have life-changing implications, but then we also want to be able to make it available to our patients. So there's a lot of work going on there. I think, like I said, that is something that needs to be addressed, and I think we all need to be talking about that. And these discussions are great, where, you know, people are mindful of that, because it's a disease that, as you mentioned, disproportionately affects a patient population that is already economically and socially at a disadvantage. So that's something that we all are looking at.
And when you talk there about advocating for patients, you know, medicine is not immune from racial injustice and disparities and everything from where research dollars go to patient care and life expectancy. And patients with sickle cell disease, they have been marginalized or not believed when seeking medical care when their bodies hurt. How will your clinic work in light of these historical injustices?
Thank you very much for that great question. I think that's a core principle of sort of like this clinic that we have started, and it's just sort of like brings all of those things together for us. And this is the reason why we did this is, when we provide care, our clinic is sort of like the first step in our bigger goal to build a comprehensive sickle cell program. And we not only provide medical care, but we serve as champions for our patients to collaborate with other hospital specialties and departments to address disease complication, but also improve patient experiences in the clinic, in the emergency department, and during admissions to the hospital. We have a lot of educational initiatives to better address the knowledge gaps, as well as the biases, which can sometimes be conscious or unconscious ones, so that you know, we can better enlighten people about that. So a lot of those initiatives are currently ongoing, and we have seen such great feedback and some response from the other providers when we have engaged with them. So I think collaboration, engagement, patient opinions and voices, they all need to be incorporated into that. And we're seeing something wonderful happening through that. So I'm very hopeful that we can take that forward and our clinic will serve as that cornerstone for to be our patient champions.
Dr. Nazif, thank you for joining us.
Yes, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Dr. Moniba Nazif, hematologist at UW Health, head of a new sickle cell disease clinic. Coming up, we learn about a nonprofit that helps Latinos with developmental disabilities navigating healthcare and education. Do you have a family member who was diagnosed with autism? Have you found support networks and resources? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. And as part of the celebration, we're sharing some of our favorite stories from Wisconsin life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about finding yourself in the summertime.
As a kid, knocking around the neighborhood with your friends can be a formative time, and the experiences from those years can resonate for decades. Matthew Lewis shares a story about finding his identity. He told it during an Ex-Fabula event, a live storytelling organization in Milwaukee.
So I was super happy that the theme tonight was identity, because it's also in the neighborhood that I grew up in. My parents live like two blocks that way. This neighborhood is like a huge part of my identity. So I thought about the times that when I was growing up, and what I really loved was my block I grew up on. My block was just really special. Like, we regularly had like block parties. In the summer, I had my crew. So there was my house and my... I'm going to call her my sister because that's basically what she became. Sister's house was two doors down. Then I had another friend two doors down, another friend. So basically every other house was a friend of mine, and we would knock on each other's doors and come get each other during the summer every day. What was interesting, though, is that there was my brother's generation, which was like all boys on our block. So they would be in the back playing basketball and doing things they were not supposed to be doing. And then I would be in the front. And I was like weird because everyone had their children spotty by that point. So, like, my sister was, like, older than me, but, like, there was no one in her generation quite yet. So she was, like, stuck with us because we were the only other people she was allowed to play with. And then there was, like, my generation, but then I was the only boy, which I didn't think anything of because it was, like, oh, like, we just all play together and eat grass. And so then came the summer where, like, my sister was kind of getting to the age where she was, like, it's not really cool to, like, hang out with y'all anymore. Which I understood, you know, at that point. I think I was still trying to play, like, Powerpuff Girls, and she was like, I don't do that anymore. She had made this friend with this girl from across the alley. Now, there's a big difference in blocks. Like, there was my block, and there was 54th Street. No offense to anyone on 54th Street. Y'all just not as lit as 55th Street. But she... Once you cross that alley, it's just a different world, you know? And she would come across, and she was just mean, you know? And I was her target. And I remember, like, every time we hung out, she just always had to, like, dig at me. And usually it was around, like, why do you always hang out with all the girls? And I was like, because ain't nobody else around. That's why. Also, I was here first. And so I remember one day we were all walking, and she and my sister had gotten pretty cool, but, like, I had that, like, innate, like, little sibling jealousy of, like, you're taking the person who I've been used to, like, spending every day with away from me and doing so in a way that's pretty, like, shady to me. And so she asked me again while we were walking up the block. And she was like, why do you hang out with all the girls? And I was like, well, you know, I like it. And, you know, I just fit, you know, like, I'm not like a normal boy. And I remember her looking at me and she was like, you're gay? At this time, I'm like 7. So I was like, I don't know what that means, but your face says it's bad. So no. But I remember being really offended and quickly, like, swallowing everything I had just said so that, like, she would not blast this any louder than it had become as a moment between us. But it also, like, I remember, like, the rest of the day I just felt really apart from everybody. So I became really aware that I was, like, the only boy and that, like, things like playing Little Sally Walker with everyone was, like, not comfortable anymore. It wasn't fun. And so that summer I remember going in the house a lot, you know, when the doorbell came, I'd be like, no, I'm going to stay in. Those things that you kind of want to hide from. So it's like that difference that everyone keeps pointing out, like, doesn't keep being the thing that sets you apart from everybody. Needless to say, everyone saw what I saw in this girl about 2 months later, and she was no longer allowed in anyone's house or yard. But it was the thing that I kind of carried with me. I identified that first moment. I am, in fact, queer. But every time someone would like police that or kind of sense it in me, I remember quickly backing away. So there's never this feeling of me for being in the closet, but always being like, nope, don't claim that word, because once I claim that word, you can officially push me out. But that's my story, so thank you for listening.
Matthew Lewis's story comes to us from Ex Fabula, a storytelling organization in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
And now we meet the founders of a Madison-based organization promoting awareness, acceptance, and inclusion of children with special needs and their families, with a special focus on lifting up and supporting Latinos with disabilities. Has your child been diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder? Where have you sought care and support systems? It's 800-642-1234. Hector Portillo is founder and director of Padres y Hijos en Acción, or Parents and Children in Action. Hector, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Good morning. And Araceli Portillo, co-founder and a bilingual nutrition educator for UW Extension. Araceli, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you. And thank you for this opportunity, as my husband said.
Araceli, can you introduce us to Mario, to your son Mario, and acquaint us with his story over the years?
Well, Mario, our son, he is an autistic, not verbal child. He is 21 year old and has been living with us since always, right? Because usually after age, they move from home, and he's with us. He was diagnostic in age 2 back in El Paso, and then we moved to Wisconsin for better opportunities, and that's it. He's a tall guy. He's a 6'4". he's very tall.
Yeah.
And I don't know what else you want to know.
Yeah. What is
him.
His personality like? What do you love about his personality?
Mario, he's very stubborn. He's very, very stubborn. But he's so sweet and smart and silly. Mario is very, very silly. We're pretty sure that he can talk or communicate verbally. Oh my God, we will have a lot of jokes from him. And and he's so sweet. He is so. He's a mama boy, but also he's very, very attached to my husband.
Yeah. Hector, you were a truck driver in El Paso, and after Mario was diagnosed with autism in 2002, you drove through 48 states looking for communities with the best care options. Why did you do that, and how did you come to Wisconsin?
Well, the doctor recommended three states, Florida, California, and Wisconsin. However, I want to take a look at another state, which one has the best opportunities for our son. So it was hard for me to start driving over the road because my daughter, Erica, born in July 2002. So it was very, very tough, the decision. And we did it. So we did it, and we land here in Wisconsin because we found it. This is the best place with better opportunities for our son at the time. He's still.
The Waisman Center in Madison has scientists who study every stage of human development, of course, autism spectrum disorder. What has your connection been like, Hector, with the center in Madison?
At the time, 2003, we don't have connection, but they welcome to us. Now we have very strong connection to the years, the service they provide to our son, and also the service they are providing to the Latino community. At this time, we are partnering with the Waisman Center and to gain a grant for Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, over $30,000 for try to promote reform of some chains and how or Latino community is served in the health system.
Araceli, you know, even though you found more support in Wisconsin, you still faced barriers. What barriers do Latino parents face as you talk with, you know, fellow parents and trying to get their children diagnosed?
Well, I think language is the first one. And then even though they have people to translate, we don't have all the what we need. We don't have what we need because the second barrier will be the culture. Culture is very important, and I think those are the two that we have barriers for our kids to be diagnostic. Also, you know what, I want to say that taboos, cultural.
Cultural taboos. Uh-huh.
Cultural taboos too. Usually in our country, when we have a kid with disabilities, we don't look for resources. We just want him to stay home, away from people. But here in Wisconsin, we have the opportunity to look for research. Like Padres e Hijos, we have those connections. And well, Lecto can tell you a little bit more about that. But those are two of the barriers that we can face with families, for family, Latino families, for our kids to be diagnostic.
Yeah. Hector, how do you encourage families to seek out diagnosis and to seek out the resources that are out there for families?
Well, that was a very good question. Well, first, we try to educate the parents, inform what kind of resources, what the benefits to looking for the diagnosis in the early age, to avoid the mistake we did it. We're trying to provide the resources. There are over the Wisconsin area, Dane County especially, for the kiddos. The kid in Wisconsin and Dane, there's around 12 mm-hmm. organizations. They are licensed to make the diagnostic. But the most popular in our community is Wyman Center, the most trusted. Mm. It's Wyman Center, and that's when we refer our families.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Hector and Araceli Portillo. They founded Padres y Hijos en Acción, or Parents and Kids in Action, several years ago to help in their own journey having a child with autism. Have you found resources to help your family in the disability community? Have you participated in this group's events? What can you share? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with the Portillos here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Latino parents of children with disabilities often face barriers when interacting with the medical system, with the education system. We're learning how one Wisconsin nonprofit is providing support for Latinos with developmental disabilities. It's called Padres y Hijos en Acción, or Parents and Children in Action, and founded by Hector and Araceli Portillo in 2017. They're with us for about 10 more minutes. Araceli, I wonder if you encounter a lack of awareness about autism and understanding how that it affects each person differently. How do you help remove the stigma and the stereotypes associated with autism?
Well, first of all, is education. Education and then communication. And also, you know what, some of the families, when the kids are diagnostic, they don't want to go out. They are afraid to tell even their relatives about the diagnostic because they don't know what they're going to think about that kid. So we suggest them that it is our role as a parent with kids with disabilities to educate mm-hmm. the community, to educate our relatives, to start with them because we don't know the empathy they're going to show after they know
their diagnosis. Oh, and Araceli, we're having a little bit difficulty hearing you. There we go. Yes. And I want to also ask you, Hector, you put on events through the nonprofit. What kind of events do you put on?
We put different events, mostly to fulfill our family's needs. One of those is biking.
Mm-hmm.
Biking and gardening at the same time.
I've seen the pictures. They look wonderful.
Yeah, most of the time also we provide information about nutrition and education classes at the three times. When and other kind of events are art. We hire or contract with a local artist
mm-hmm.
to teach our kiddos how to draw and in canvas. So there's another kind of events we do is bowling.
Mm-hmm.
And jumping and trampolines, theme parks here
yeah.
when it's possible. But also we provide a lot of workshops to train the families regarding to how to navigate the educational system. And now we're focused in health system. While we provide this kind of workshops, we provide to our kids with activities. Our craft and another kind of thing, also physical activities like soccer or basketball. This is an example of activities we provide to our families.
Yeah. Araceli, you know, sometimes families need a break from the caregiving. How do you approach respite care? We're having difficulty hearing you, Araceli. I'm not sure if there's something wrong with the phone. Can you try one more time?
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you a little bit better. Go ahead.
It's okay. It's just an answer to the question. Because, yeah, I don't know what's going on with my phone. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, and Hector, you know, now that Mario is 21, what are you thinking about in terms of Mario's aging and becoming an adult living with autism? What are some of the new things that you think about for his life?
Well, we want him to be independent. He is very smart, but learn a very slow pace. We are trying to train him in what's best for him. So still looking in his skills. However, we are opening for more opportunities for him. We want to him independent living, but doesn't mean going to replace him in a house or an apartment. He wants to live with us, but we want him around the community, be part of the community. It's one of the plan we have for kids. You and I can answer that speed question.
Yeah. Araceli, what are some things that you're thinking about as Mario becomes an adult?
Well, it is difficult because we have to deal. I mean, he's autistic, but other than that, he is like a normal teenager with his needs, you know. So it is difficult for him because, as I mentioned before, sadly, the community is not educated.
Mm-hmm.
We don't find empathy sometimes. It is difficult, especially because he's verbal. I mean, and also because the autism, you can see it not actually physically. Mm-hmm. If you see Mario, you can see like he is kind of average. As soon as he starts making those noises, and that's when you realize that something is wrong with him. So being outside and with some people, they look at him, and we still have that that issues, if we can call it like that, in the community. And that's why I was telling you before that we tell the families that it is our role the families of parents and kids with disabilities to educate,
mm-hmm.
to educate our relatives and the community, not to hide our kids, but they have to understand that they're different, but they're part of the society. They're part of this community.
Not to hide our children. They are part of the community. We're learning about the work of Padres y Hijos en Acción. It's a group focusing on helping the Latino community navigate disabilities and resources out there, founded by Hector and Araceli Portillo. Araceli, a bilingual nutrition educator as well for UW Extension. Let's bring in Amy in Madison. Hi, Amy. Go ahead. Amy, are you there? I think we've lost Amy. I want to go to Hector. Your organization recently received a $330,000 grant from the UW Weissman Center as part of a 3-year campaign project. How will you use the money?
Well, you use to promote empowering families, parents, how to express how the system is working with them, what was good, what was wrong, and what kind of suggestion or recommendation they have. The goal is create groups to empower the families and with the organization who are providing service to our families to create ways to close the gap in the service, trying to inclusion and equity in our service. This is our goal in 3 years. Create and find out and collect data direct for our families and also with the providers and sit together, negotiate for more negotiation and co-create change or reforms to improve the quality of life or of other families and improving the health service.
Yeah. Amy, I'm going to go back to you. Amy and Madison, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm listening to this wonderful story and just wanted to honor and thank Araceli and Hector. You know, not only does raising a child with autism come with its own challenges, but for you to truly take action and provide a space for Spanish-speaking families as well as, you know, Latinx families in Wisconsin. We're so fortunate that you chose this state out of all the ones you traveled to. And, you know, Gandhi would be proud. You are being the change you wish to see in this world. So thank you so much for your work.
Oh, Amy, thank you for that. Hector and Araceli Portillo, thank you so much. Founded Padres y Hijos en Acción in 2017. We have a link to their nonprofit at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.